Greetings, everybody. Welcome to the Classroom 33 podcast. I'm Pastor Dustin here with Steve Prudian, and today we are continuing in Psalms, and we're doing part two of Psalm 22. It's one that you may know because Jesus quoted it while he was on the cross. So, part two, we're going to be starting kind of in the middle. We're going to go back a little bit from last week and then continue. So, yeah, Steve, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing fine this week.
Good.
I'd rather not think about it. Yeah. It's always fine until I think about it.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden I find something that I forgot to do. Then it's not fine anymore.
You're right. All right, well, we are in Psalm 22. And what are we looking at today? Because last week we talked a lot about more of the history of David and where this psalm is coming from as he's writing it.
Yeah, and we talked about his pain.
Yes.
And the fact is that even though this is synonymous with the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, in some of this I see actual events in David's life.
Correct.
Okay, where he is actually experiencing the pain, but it is uncannily very similar to the pain that Jesus Christ would suffer 1,000 years later on the cross.
Right.
I find that kind of a, I won't say a fitting tribute, but the thing is that Jesus is a descendant of David.
Right.
So the very persecution that David experienced as the king, Jesus Christ also experienced the same type of persecution. And he didn't even declare himself as king. Others did.
Right. Well, yeah, and it seems to be right in line with a lot of other prophetic things. There's types and patterns, and when God promises that he's going to put a king on David's throne, it makes sense that there would be...
Whose throne? David's throne. The title of the throne tells you it has to be an heir of David.
Right. But to have that heir of David's throne is going to not only inherit all of the good, but the bad as well. So it makes sense that both the persecution and the coming reign, because although David was anointed king, and rightfully so, could have claimed the title at any time, he didn't until Saul was fully and completely deposed by his enemy. So I guess we have to wait until our Saul is fully and completely deposed. And then Christ will come back. Anyways, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself because we're talking crucifixion and I'm talking second coming now. So,
hey, wait a second.
What?
In this psalm,
yes.
In this psalm, there is the period where Jesus reigns.
Yes, there is.
That's right.
There
so you're
is.
Not ahead of yourself.
Well, I'm a little...
You're in the same chapter.
I'm in the same chapter. Maybe only like 25 or 30 minutes ahead of myself.
Right.
So David was prayerful. Like many others, he spoke to God, and we speak to God, and he was called by God a man after God's own heart. And that's a pretty incredible thing to say, to call David a man after God's own heart. And what's interesting is that I don't think anybody else in Scripture gets that description.
Not that I know of. What quality of God's heart?
I guess I'm not sure.
I would call God's heart a loving heart.
Oh, for sure.
And the fact is he showers his love on his children in multiple ways.
Mm-hmm.
But David showered his love back to God. And how many of us shower God with our love? We want to take from him, but we don't want to give very much back to him.
Right. Well, that's a good way of putting it.
I find it funny that in the Bible it talks about we're supposed to worship God with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs.
Yep.
Now, why would it say psalms?
Psalms are, the word psalm is most like, in meaning, is most like what we would today call poetry.
Right. But who is accredited? Who is credited usually for psalms?
God.
Who else?
Typically.
Who else? The Psalms of?
David.
David.
Yeah.
Okay. And God says, he is a man after my own heart.
Mm-hmm.
Give credit where credit's due.
Yes.
And David gave credit where credit's due.
Yes, he did.
And that's the only reason he was able to face Goliath.
Oh, for sure.
Right. Because he was given credit to God for the times of victory he had as a shepherd.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and he also approached his battle with Goliath with, I would say, like, a righteous anger. He was mad. He was mad that Goliath would scorn and mock God, and he was mad that Saul and all of his army would just stand there and let it happen. And he wasn't going to put up with it.
What's the difference between David and the army?
Well, David actually knew God.
That's exactly right. He knew how to exercise faith.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Where Saul and his army were just men of the flesh.
Right.
They didn't have any faith.
No. No.
But we do the same thing.
Sure we do.
We get in trouble. What we try to do? We try to get out of it ourselves.
Yep.
What should we do? Take it to God
exercise
like David
faith.
Did.
If I was smarter than I am, I know how I would react. Well, let's get back to Psalm 22 here. We kind of already talked about this, but Jesus calls back to this psalm. And not only is he speaking the words, because I think he's actually speaking the words and meaning the words, although he knows the answer, he's still asking the question, God, why have you forsaken me? Because the people needed to hear him ask the question. But at the same time, it's a rabbinic technique to start a section of scripture for your student so that your student in their memory, because this was a time of memorizing, and they would have had the Psalms memorized. So Jesus saying this from the cross would have brought Psalm 22 to their mind, and they would have, or would have been expected to, recite the entire psalm in their head, or to themselves, or however. And so he was literally calling back to this psalm. And I don't think there's any biblical scholars out there that argue with that. I think everybody is in agreement. Every biblical scholar is in agreement, as far as I know, on that.
Could the psalm be projecting what would happen to David's heir in the future?
Well, there's a reason that he called back to it, and I think we should go into the psalm and see what the psalm says and what we think.
How did most prophets hear from God?
Visions, dreams, things like that, spirit, inspiration.
They said, and the Holy Ghost came upon them.
Yep.
Came and went. But usually when it came, mm-hmm. okay, it inspired these people, including David, to pen what was being said. Now, right. whether or not all of this applied to David's own experience, some of it has, but some of it could not. Well, we could try to make it apply to David, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is that David did physically write this psalm.
Right.
And what's interesting is that Jesus was the fulfillment of this psalm.
Yes, he was. Yeah, and all these things that David is writing, if it does apply to him, much of it would be literal, but there's some of it that would have to be some
futuristic
or,
because there was no crosses at David's time. That was a Roman symbol.
No, but I think about verses 14 and 15. He says, I'm poured out like water and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd and my tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death. There is not a moment in David's life that he would have experienced that literally. However, there might be some poetic hyperbole in describing his own life in that. However, we do know that Jesus experienced that exactly. So there is definitely some spirit inspiration there to have David, you know, if David knows that he's writing a prophecy, then it's not about him at all. If he doesn't know that he's writing a prophecy, then it's an exaggeration of his experiences that the Spirit inspires to just so happen be perfect to describe Christ. And now I don't know what David's state of mind was when he wrote it, but that's my scholarly take on it, if you will.
We do know that David was fleeing for his life because he felt forsaken.
Yes.
Okay, by people who were within his own family.
Yes.
And even the priest forsook him, and the military forsook him.
Yes.
Now, for a guy who was the commander-in-chief, to all of a sudden have your military churn against you, that's a little hard to take.
It's a little devastating.
Especially when you fought with them.
Right.
Right. The fact is that the physical descriptions that David is talking about, they could have been battlefield conditions. We do know that David spent a good part of his life trying to elude and escape from the ravages of Saul. Who wanted to take his life, to the very point that he feigned craziness to seek protection with the Philistines.
Right.
Okay. But yet, the Philistines knew that he could kill giants. But they still took him in because they thought he was just crazy. But the fact is that if you look at the physical thing about the weakness and the being wasted and thirsty and bones that hurt and joints and a heart that is feeling like wax that can't hardly beat anymore. That's basically a battle-worn fatigue syndrome.
Yes, it is.
We would call it today what? And you know what it's called?
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Exactly.
Yep.
And that you can feel all of those things and not understand why you're feeling them.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely you can.
So the reality is that David wasn't writing about policemen, firemen, or today's military, because it was even happening back then.
Well,
just an idea.
Solomon writes that there's nothing new under the sun. And we know PTSD isn't new because it's an evolved understanding of something that, if you go all the way back to World War I, they called it shell shock.
Mm-hmm.
And they just wrote it off. And so, at least now it's a little bit better understood. But let's get back to...
Let me make one more statement.
Okay.
I can't make the statement as a factual statement.
Sure.
But I did hear this statement from a person who knew war well.
All right.
And the statement is, you can't be living with death for a long period of time and have it not affect you.
Right.
What that means, that was the end of the statement. I didn't get explanation.
I'm not even going to start to go into that. I have a feeling my explanation from just hearing it and processing it would be
too much of a strain, a pain.
Let's call it cumbersome.
You don't want to bring that back up. It's like vomiting.
No. It would be cumbersome. I'm just going to put it that way. So where do we want to start here?
Well, start with "My God, my God." It's his most famous line from the cross.
Yep.
People say his most famous line is "forgive them, they don't know what they do." But he didn't say that until he said, "My God, my God."
He had to say, "My God, my God," to get their attention. Yeah, he says, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?"
My problem is that there's times like I felt like that. Probably times that you feel like that.
Oh, sure.
Probably times that everybody feels like that. What does that word forsaken look like?
To forsake is to make a choice to have nothing to do with, to turn your back on, to turn your back to a person.
What was the relationship before that? What's the relationship that is churning?
Mm-hmm.
There's where the hurt is. The hurt is that the relationship is being taken away.
Right.
And there's nothing you can do about it.
Right. The father and son relationship, the father is severing that, removing that. All the love, all the grace, all the protection, all of the fatherly influence, everything is just gone.
And who is the son to the father? Ask that question. Who is or what is a son to a father?
Pride and joy.
He's the extension of who the father is.
Right.
And when your father says, "I don't want to have anything more to do with you."
Right.
What does that do to the son?
Crushes him. Emotionally and physically.
Feels unworthy, hopeless, paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
So there we have Jesus, "My God, my God."
Right. Right, and I can hear the agony in it. I can feel the agony in it. And he knows it's coming. Not 12, but not 24 hours earlier.
Mm-hmm.
He had been praying and so broken in his spirit that his sweat was dropping as drops of blood. He had blood. He had such a extreme I don't know what word I'm looking for.
To sweat drops of blood.
Right.
You got to be pretty intent.
Yes. Yeah, it's an in, intensity. It's an intensity. It's an anxiety. It's just an very, very intense feeling.
What makes you sweat in the first place? Just regular sweat. What makes you sweat in the first place?
Fear.
What else?
Like exercise, like strain.
Exhaustion.
Yeah. Jesus. But the intensity of the motion, that capillaries in your skin burst so that the blood mixes with the sweat and falls to the ground like that,
That's called tension. A great deal of tension.
Hypertension doesn't even begin to describe it, but unfortunately that has a connotation. So,
ever stretched out an elastic band and it breaks?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
We all experience to some degree feeling like God has forsaken us. Now, the reality in our case is we've typically turned our back on God, not the other way.
We don't say, my God. We say, oh, God.
Right.
What's the difference?
A lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot. We could do an hour just on that. But yeah, the difference is you're not claiming ownership of your part in that relationship when you say, oh, God, instead of my God. That's why I say it's typically when we say it, we've turned our back.
Oh, God means it's his fault. When you use it like that, oh, God.
Right. So yeah, we've all felt that. And usually we try to place the blame on God. It's our own fault, but we blame him. We do that with each other, too.
How does that affect us?
Well,
I'm not talking theologically.
No.
How does that affect us?
Well, it's a really interesting effect, because when I make the mistake, but I blame you, two things happen. Maybe more than two things. But the first is there is a break of trust between you and I.
Relationships severed.
Right. The relationship is broken. It may not be completely shattered, but it is now certainly broken. It is not as it was before. And so there's less trust. If you know that I blame you, you're going to distrust me because you probably see that it's my fault. And I'm blaming you. And so I won't go into all the cycle babble, but that inherently causes me to distrust you because I'm projecting my guilt onto you for my situation. So now I don't trust you.
So you're transferring.
Yep. I'm transferring it. And at the same time, I'm planting in myself a seed of bitterness that is going to continue to sour the relationship. And it's going to erode me as a person. Bitterness just eats you from the inside out.
Oh, so you're a mountain builder. You built a mountain out of a molehill.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm really good at doing that. So that's what I see happening. That's how it plays out in my head, how it has played out in my past. But what we should be doing is trust in that peace. Instead of blaming God, or anybody for that matter, we need to, number one, confess whatever it is that's separated us from God and caused that moment to happen. But there's a peace that passes all understanding. And, you know, Jesus was an example of that. the one guy on the cross and the crowd that was heckling him and mocking him, they weren't wrong. He could have called a legion of angels down from heaven to take him off of the cross. They're not wrong. He could have done that. He chose to rest and trust in God's plan, even while being forsaken by God. As the only person in existence to have been forsaken by God, he chose to still trust him. Then I think that speaks volumes. You know, for me to go through my life and not be able to trust God with something so trivial as finances, car, gas, food.
Just living.
Waking up in the morning, having heat in the winter and air conditioning in the summer. If I can't trust God to provide what I need, just on a day-to-day, what does that say about me?
Oh, ye of little faith?
Exactly, especially when you look at Jesus trusting God and resting in that peace while he's being forsaken. And we know that God is actively chasing after us.
You know, you being a family pastor.
Yes.
When a phone call comes in, you may be the first person that that phone call comes into.
Sure.
And usually it's a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Or minimally, it's a prayer request.
Right.
Have you ever thought about the person who's making that phone call? What they're going through? What they're feeling?
How can you not?
How afraid are they?
How can you not?
There's some people that are just basically, they just do their job. It's just part of the job.
I don't know how you...
But you empathize.
There's an empathy, yeah.
You feel.
Absolutely, I do.
The craziest thing is that what can you do from that chair?
The only thing I can do is talk to them and talk to God.
Right. That's the only thing you can do.
That's the only thing I can do.
Poor David.
Right.
Poor David. He was going through something, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Who could he call? No one. Only God.
Only God.
Only God, because everybody else had deserted him.
Right.
Actually, I won't say that. He had about 2 to 4 people that he could still trust in.
Yeah, he had a handful of people
and
that
were... And they went with him.
Right. And there's a couple of people that were still in Jerusalem that...
Mm-hmm. He left a couple of plants there.
Yeah.
Right, to report to him.
Well, and to keep the throne empty while he was gone.
Do you know how far David went? Do you know how far
he went? Physically, no, I don't know how far he went.
To get out of the reach, okay, of Absalom and his own army,
mm-hmm.
okay, he actually had to leave Israel and cross over to the other side of the Jordan.
Okay.
Okay? He had to, like... When he had to flee from Saul,
yep.
he had to leave Israel and flee to the Philistia, or Philistines.
Yep.
And when David was fleeing from Absalom, he had to leave his kingdom, okay?
Right.
And flee to another kingdom.
Right.
Okay, and that kingdom at that time would be Moabites.
Okay. Hmm. Very interesting.
Just kind of interesting.
Yeah. All right, well, let's move on.
We need to talk about David and Jesus, the similarities.
We do.
Did you catch the title of this podcast?
The title you've got on your notes here? Yeah, The Despised and Hated King.
It's an oxymoron. I'm not saying the king's a moron.
Despised and hated?
Yeah, because usually kings are loved. They're not despised and hated.
Right.
When David first became king, everybody loved him being king.
He was beloved, even. Yep.
What was the main thing that went wrong? One thing that caused this whole thing to slide.
Well, it seems like the pivoting point is Bathsheba.
Uriah's murder.
Well, that started with
Bathsheba, right.
With Bathsheba, with taking Bathsheba that didn't belong to him.
Yeah.
And then he called Uriah back from the front lines, and
yep.
He refused to do what David wanted.
Hey, he didn't play the game.
He didn't play the game. And so he got sent back to the front lines and killed.
Yeah.
The scapegoat. That's the whole entangled mess that starts this. Yep.
Nathan the prophet called it out.
He did.
And he called David out. And the problem is that we found the weak point in David's armor.
A little bit, yeah.
It's interesting. Satan finds the weak point in any Christian's armor.
Sure he does.
What was David's weak point?
Well, two things.
Okay.
I think he was supposed to be at war. So he was enjoying the comfort of home a little bit too much.
Complacency?
A little bit of complacency. And a little bit of, just say, womanizing?
Lust.
Lust. There you go. That's a better Lust. Word. That's a better word.
And it got him.
Sure, it got him.
Even though he knew better.
Yep.
It got him.
Mm-hmm.
What does that say to us? This is a lesson to be learned here.
Yeah, keep your guard up.
Don't get lazy with God or with Jesus or with your faith.
Right.
Because when you get lazy,
mm-hmm.
okay, you're going to become weak.
Right.
And when you become weak, you do stupid things.
Yes.
And the stupid things lead to sin.
And then consequences.
And that consequence is forsakenness.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you forsaken from that's the most that matters most?
God.
God. Now you know why it's my God.
Yep. Yep. So, all right. Getting back into the words of the psalm. We've got I already talked about, I jumped ahead a little bit talking about 14 and 15. But if we go back a little ways, we've got verse 6. David writes, "But I am a worm and not human, scorned by others and despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They make faces at me. They shake their heads." That's sounds like somebody who's definitely despised, definitely hated. You know, people don't typically mock and make faces at somebody that that they like.
You know the story behind this, don't you? There is a reason and a story behind this.
There is.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
David was accused by his own son.
Okay.
Of not caring for the people.
Okay.
So
yep.
So the son took it upon himself to care for the people when he didn't have the authority to care for the people.
Right.
He also made judgments in place of the king.
Right.
That he didn't have the right to do either.
Right.
Okay. However, I'm going to be Absalom, the son's king, and you are going to be the public that came to listen to me.
Okay.
And I'm going to say, You know, my father was a great man.
Okay.
But he, you know, he slipped up. He made a big mistake. And you know what? He made you and your relatives pay for his mistake. He told God, when he was given a choice of taking punishment upon himself for how he sinned against God.
Right.
He used you and your relatives as the price to be paid. So 70,000
yep.
of your family died.
That's not fair.
Because of my father's sin with that woman.
That's not fair. That's not right.
Okay, so now, when he's chased out of his kingdom, the description fits.
Yeah.
Okay? He's being chased out because he's disgraced.
Yes, he is.
He's disgraced. And this is the statement of a disgraced person. I like the last part of verse 8, which you heard at the foot of the cross by the Pharisees, not the Romans. The Romans didn't care. They were just doing their job. They were impartial. Okay?
Yep.
They did this every day. Okay? So, but the Pharisees, in their mocking, what does yep. that verse 8 say?
Let the Lord rescue him. Let God save him.
And that's more mocking.
Yes, it is.
That's more mocking.
Well, they're not saying it seriously. It's absolutely sarcastic.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
However, Dustin, it can happen to anybody.
Sure it can.
And you have to admit, okay, it will hurt.
Yes, it will.
It will hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, it'll make us do things that we wouldn't have normally done.
Mm-hmm.
I find it interesting that David responds the way probably we would respond. We run away.
Yep.
We run away. We don't want to face it.
Right. We don't.
You know how old David was when this was happening?
Was he about 60?
67 years old.
67, okay.
67 years old when this was happening. I don't think I'd like to be 67 years old and on the run.
No.
From the people with weapons.
No. No.
So, David writes this. Jesus experiences this, but David experienced this as well.
Yes, he did.
Okay, he just said it based upon what was happening to him. If you go on through, you're going to also find some other similarities that actually could or did happen to David that a lot of us can't identify with because we're trying to project it to a time 1,000 years further out.
Right.
Okay? And saying, well, this couldn't have happened to David because that wasn't done until 1,000 years later.
Right.
And that's mainly about his hands and his feet were pierced.
Right. Yeah, and that's... It comes a little bit further down the line, verse 16. Sorry, we've got to switch versions here.
That's okay. This came out of NIV, by the way.
Yeah,
and my particular notes.
Well, most translations do have pierced. As a matter of fact, I've got 6 translations up side by side, and only one of them doesn't say pierced, which is interesting. It says shriveled instead. But out of the NIV, it says, dogs surround me, a pack of villains encircles me. They pierce my hands and my feet.
That was a tactic of torture that they were used to try to get an enemy combatant to basically to talk.
Okay.
So if people think it only happened on the cross, it didn't happen only on the cross. They also
No, it didn't.
They also did that so the prisoner couldn't run away.
Right, and they also can't hold a weapon or use any tools.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So they say, well, David couldn't have written that. I said, what was David most familiar with? War.
Yeah, he would have been familiar with prisoners of war and tactics and things for that.
He also knew what the Philistine did to captives.
What did the Philistines do to their captives?
They pierced them. They made them talk.
Yep.
The word doesn't say nailed.
It doesn't.
Jesus was nailed to a cross.
Mm-hmm.
But you can pierce with things other than nails and make it hurt.
I would think being pierced by pretty much anything would hurt.
Right.
So, yeah.
If you can't use your hands, you can't fight. If you can't use your feet, you can't run.
Right.
They got you.
They got you.
They got you.
They got you.
However, the word pierced is synonymous with the word that we identify with as what today? Sin nails us.
Oh, right, yeah.
Okay. Sin nails us. It's just like the pain that Jesus was afflicted with by being pierced. Sin pierces us.
Yep, sure does.
But the craziest thing is that he got pierced, but yet he died for our piercing.
Yes, he did. All right. Sorry, got lost in a little bit of study there.
It's okay.
Just looking up a meaning here. Anyways, so as we move ahead here, in verse 18, it says, they divided my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Now, I'll be honest, I've never really stopped and considered why. And it's really interesting that I haven't stopped to consider why, because Jesus wasn't, I mean, he had been stripped. He'd been beaten. He'd been given a purple robe, which is the color of royalty, and mocked, and the crown of thorns. And so what clothes he's going to have are clothes that were put on him to mock him.
And filled with the blood of his beatings.
Right.
They didn't smell very good.
I can imagine not. But no, I can honestly say I've never actually stopped and thought, why would they be casting lots for his clothing?
Because it was prophesied.
Right.
They were fulfilling the prophecy. What was the value of his clothes? Could they sell it? No.
If you could get it cleaned up enough, maybe.
It's a dead man's clothes.
No, it's a trophy is what it is.
Only to who? Who's playing? Who's playing
the Romans?
The Romans.
It's not a
religious symbol.
No, it is a trophy to those who are crucifying him. That's all it is.
It's how they occupied their time while the man was dying.
Oh, I'm sure.
Right, and they had to play for something. So they played for the one thing that was available. That belonged to no one. Winner take all.
Right. Yeah.
You know what?
What?
The winner did take all.
Mm-hmm.
And who's the winner?
God.
Well, Jesus is the winner.
Or Jesus.
Jesus is the winner.
Sure.
But what was the cost for
taking
all? Everything.
Yeah.
Was Jesus' bloodstained clothes the victory?
No.
Was his time on the cross the victory?
No.
How did he win?
The empty tomb.
The resurrection.
And the folded up grave wrappings or clothes or whatever. Yeah.
Oh, death, where is thy sting?
Mm-hmm.
Where is thy victory?
Yep.
Jesus is the victory. Death didn't win.
Yeah. Why do you come here looking for somebody who's not here?
And yet we have religious organizations today to focus on pieces of cloth.
Right.
But the Romans had it right. It didn't have any value. It was just worth playing a game over.
Right. It's just a trophy.
Right.
That's all it is. It's a symbolic of a moment that happened in the past.
Well, if we were playing cards, we would call it worthless chips.
Mm-hmm.
You have the chips, but they're really worthless.
Right. Right.
So, we shouldn't worship the relic. We should worship the living Christ.
Yes, we should. Yes, we should. Let's move up here to where it talks about Christ a little bit. Because we get somewhat more literal here in about verse 24. Says, for he has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him, but he has listened to his cry for help. And that's in regards to God. God has not despised or scorned the suffering or afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. So, that would be Jesus. He's the afflicted one. He's the one being punished. He's the one being scorned. And even though God has forsaken him, he has severed that, he never stops loving him. And he's still listening to him. But in that moment, he's doing what must be done.
Do you see my note?
I do see your note.
His cry?
Mm-hmm.
What's his cry?
Forgiving us of our sins. That's the second most popular, most well-known thing that Jesus said from the cross. Forgive them. They don't know what they're doing.
And did God answer that prayer?
Yes, he did. He absolutely did. He did by then allowing Jesus to sacrifice his life, to finalize the sacrifice in order to pay the sins. He paid the blood wage for our sins so that we don't have to go through torment and hell and separation from God.
When he said, it is finished, what is the it?
Okay, so I'm going to get a little bit scholarly on that. The it that he's referring to, in my understanding, at least one of the its, because it's a loaded it, if you will. There is a covenant between God and between Abraham. And that's a foreshadowing of Christ. But there is a promise made. And there is a promise made that you know, he would be our God and we would be his people, and we would exceed the numbers of the stars in the sky or the sand on the beach. And in making of that covenant, God had Abraham, or Abram at the time, cut some animals in half and put them on either side of an aisle. And then Abraham falls asleep, and God goes through it essentially twice. And this is the fulfilling of that covenant. We have broken that covenant. The Israelite people, the descendants of Abraham, broke that covenant over and over and over and over again.
And they're still breaking it.
And they're still breaking it, and we still break it.
Yes, because we're all sinners.
But in that second going through, God said, God's promise was that if you break this covenant, instead of doing to you what was done to these animals, you will do to me what was done to these animals. That's what God is saying. And so he's taking the punishment for our breaking of that covenant. That's the it that comes to my mind first when I think about the it is finished. And by extension from that covenant, every covenant that God makes with his people has been broken over and over and over and over by his people. And this is the fulfilling of all of those contracts. This is taking the punishment for breaking all of those covenants, all of those contracts.
And death from sin, it is finished.
Yes.
Because Jesus is the finishing work.
Yes.
However, you have to come to Jesus to have the finishing done in your life.
Right.
Just because Jesus did it, that doesn't mean you get it for doing absolutely nothing.
Right. And
it doesn't happen by osmosis.
No, it doesn't happen.
Your parents can't give it to you.
Now, I'm gonna use a different analogy.
Okay.
So here's the thing with the covenant, and it is finished and it's done. If somebody came to you today with a contract that basically said you bought a whole bunch of shares of Apple in the mid to late 80s. And now you get to reap the benefits of a reward of something you didn't actually do. And all you had to do was sign a contract that's already been completed in every way. There is no requirement on your part to do anything. All you have to do is sign your name on the line and receive your payment. Who in their right mind would turn that down?
Not many people, unless they figure it's going to be worth more in the future.
Well, If I had a contract to give you these shares of Apple, would you turn it down?
No.
Why not?
Because they have value.
And what did you have to do?
Not much.
Not much.
I had to receive it.
You had to receive it. That's what God's doing for us.
And I say, okay.
He invested in us through Christ 2,000 years ago. And all we have to do is sign on the dotted line and we get eternal life with him in heaven.
You say, what's the catch? Too good to be true. What's the catch?
It's the only thing that seems too good to be true that isn't. There's no catch.
But as human beings, we think there's always a catch.
Of course, because we're too used to dealing with human beings where there's always a catch.
That's right. Yeah, we're conditioned.
Right. Exactly. But there is no catch. It's all about believing and receiving. And sometimes you believe and then you receive. And sometimes you receive and then you believe.
Or sometimes you can be like the heroes of the faith that did not receive in this life.
Right.
But they were looking for the life to come.
Exactly. That was better than I was going to put it, for sure. Okay. I started this whole thing by talking about the future. Let's finish it by talking about the future. The last part of our psalm, verses 27 through 31, all the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him, for dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. All the rich of the earth will feast and worship. All who go down to the dust will kneel before him, those who cannot keep themselves alive. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. There's that it again.
Never ignore the it.
Never ignore the it. Dominion belongs to the Lord. He rules over the nations. And although he is anointed as king, and the throne is rightfully his, he does not yet sit upon it.
Just like David.
Just like David.
He was anointed as king, but he didn't usurp it. He didn't take it before it was given to him.
There was a time when it would come due to him, and that time is coming soon.
Well, he said he was coming soon.
He said he was coming soon.
Do you have to make a reservation? Do you know that?
Yep.
You got to make a reservation. And where does...
At very least, call ahead seating.
Yeah. And where is the reservation recorded?
In the book of life.
In the book of life. But you got to make the reservation.
Right.
Okay? He's done all he's going to do for you. You got to make the call. It's in your hands.
That's it.
Okay?
It's as easy as that.
Are you ready?
Well, yes. You know. Yes, I'm. Man, that's a loaded question. Because, yes, I. Moving from here to there is going to be a glorious moment. You know, for the person who passes, death is stepping through the door that John walked through in Revelation, right? It's walking, it's stepping into the throne room of God.
And Isaiah, it is being, and Isaiah.
And yeah. And being in God's presence from that moment until eternity, which is to say forever. And there is nothing bad about that. There's nothing about that that I'm not looking forward to. But I'm not in a hurry, because I feel like I got something to do here still.
The word ready has a synonymous word to it, or condition, really, to readiness.
Okay, and what's that?
You know what that word is?
What's that word?
That word begins with A, and it means, let me see, it says. I'll get it in a minute. It means that you're in a state of readiness. The word is anticipation.
Okay.
You're in the state of anticipation.
Okay, because I would have come up with prepared.
Okay. That... But you're anticipating, right. And that's the reason why you're getting ready. Okay, mm-hmm. For the promise of things fulfilled.
Right.
So, are you and I living under the promise of things fulfilled?
Not quite yet.
Well, we're living under the promise.
Right.
We're waiting for the day of our fulfillment.
Right, we're living under the promise of things that will be fulfilled.
Right. However, guess what?
What's that?
this is better than your shares of Apple.
Right.
Heaven and earth shall
pass away. Every analogy breaks down at some point or another.
Heaven and earth will pass away, including Apple.
Yes, it will. Yes, it will. All right. I think we have, at least for the time being, exhausted Psalm 22. What do we have to look forward to next week?
Well, the psalm that is called the Beloved Psalm.
The Beloved Psalm.
And which psalm is called the Beloved Psalm?
Well, if I had to guess, I would guess the one right after 22.
Exactly. And it's interesting. You go from, my God, why have you forsaken me? Right into the 23rd Psalm.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.
So what do we know about, my God, why have you forsaken me? He has really not forsaken me.
He has forsaken nothing.
Right. In the moment, we may feel forsaken.
And in that moment on the cross, Christ absolutely was.
But then, the shepherd shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're going to go, the Beloved Psalm.
All right. Looking forward to it. Thank you very much, Steve.